Hey, everybody, it's Glenn Thrush with the Off Message Podcast. Our guest this week is Senator Jeff Sessions, a junior senator from Alabama. And here's something you didn't know about me. I spent 2.5 years of my life in Birmingham, Alabama. It is kind of, weirdly, my second home. I love Alabama. Did a lot of reporting down there. It was my first daily job at the Birmingham Post-Herald, a paper which has died. The fact that I worked there, I don't think it had anything to do with it, but who the hell knows? Jeff Sessions is a very interesting person, interesting for a couple of reasons. Firstly, he is the most vocal supporter of Donald Trump in the Senate, endorsed him early on, put on the Make America Great hat at a rally last summer in Mobile, one of the first names politically to jump on board the Trump bandwagon. And secondly, because he comes from an interesting place and came there from at an interesting time. He is from a tiny fly speck on the map called Hibbert, Alabama, which is located in one of the richest literary and civil rights territories in the United States of America. It is a town, and one of the real funny parts of the interview is he was talking about growing up in this idyllic situation. By the way, I pointed out that it wasn't quite so idyllic for the black folks who lived up the road. He grew up with a couple of dozen families in a real Huckleberry Finn kind of boyhood. And that town, Hibbert, now has exactly one resident. It had a few had a few dozen families and is down to one old lady living in a nearly empty old house. But the truth of the matter is, whenever you have a politician coming from that state offering prescriptions to the rest of the country about how they ought to run their state, I think it's important to understand just how difficult life in Alabama can be if you are poor. Let me give you a story from the early 1990s when I was a reporter heading into the Black Belt. There's a county called Greene County. It's near Lowndes County. Lowndes County, Alabama, and Greene County, Alabama, were on the famous 1965 Selma Civil Rights March. And Lowndes County, by the way, next to Greene County, is where the Black Panthers were born. Well, Greene County, in 1992, 1993, as I was covering education, I read in a little newsletter that the Greene County schools were going to open in November. You heard me right, November. Most schools open in September. A lot of schools now open in August. It's going to open 2 months late. It was just one line in a newsletter. And I got in my 78 Caprice Classic station wagon and drove down there and discovered that the reason why the school was going to open late is because there was a dog track in Greene County that generated most of the revenue for the black school system. Now, in Alabama, you had city school systems and county school systems. In most counties, if the city school system was black, the county was white. If the county was black, the city was white. In this instance, in Greene County, the county school system was black. Well, anyway, the dog track went belly up because gambling was coming to the Gulf Coast of Mississippi. So all the money, all the revenue that was being generated in Greene County, Alabama, that went right to the schools, poof, it was gone. So, because the state of Alabama doesn't tax its citizens in the way that other states do for education, the state couldn't step in and keep these schools open. So you had a situation in Alabama where you had a 100% black school system opening nearly 2 months late. And when I went into the high school in Greene County, I walked into a history class, and the boys and girls were sitting on the floor because they couldn't afford chairs and desks. I will never forget that as long as I live. With that, here's a conversation with Jeff Sessions. First, a little bit of business. Follow us on iTunes. Rate us. We're getting some really good ratings. And continue to send me feedback and suggestions on guests. I should tell you guys, Jeff Sessions, several people had sent me emails suggesting I talk to him. So he is one of the first guests that we've had that have come from our suggestion box online. You can always get me at gthrush@politico.com. And without any further ado, here's Jeff Sessions. So good morning, Senator Sessions. How you doing?
Thank you, Glenn.
So I'm looking here and I see on your couch, we're in your office in the Russell Senate office building, and I see on one side of the couch you got an Auburn helmet, and on the other side of the couch you got the University of Alabama helmet. You going to tell me which one that you really, really, really root for in the Iron Bowl?
I'm whenever they're in the national championship game, I'm for that one. I went to law school at Alabama, and I grew up a loyal Auburn fan. I'm one of the few that wrestles with those issues sometimes, but we're really proud of them. Like, the University of Alabama has almost doubled its enrollment. Its academic scores are up.
Well, I was there in 92 as a reporter, as a baby reporter, when I had a full head of hair for the Birmingham Post-Herald, and I was there for the national championship in 92 when it was Gene Stallings. And I was trying to remember who the quarterback was. He blew out his knee before the championship, before the SEC championship game, and I visited him in the hospital. I just don't remember what the guy's name was. So anyway, can we start off talking a little bit about Alabama? I love Alabama. I worked there for a long time. You grew up in a small town, right? Sort of in the Selma, Monroeville, southeast of Montgomery. Tell me a little bit about the town that you grew up
right.
in.
Right. I grew up really in the country. There's a little crossroads community there. When I was a kid, there were three country stores, a railroad depot, and a post office.
Wow.
Now we're down to one person.
One
most
person?
Of the houses are gone, and all the kids that I grew up with in an almost idyllic environment, I got to tell you, it was so wonderful. They've gone on, and they're doctors and PhDs, and everybody has a four-year college degree. None of our parents, I think, had a four-year degree.
What'd your dad do? What'd your mom do?
My father had a country store, and then later, when I was 10 or 12, sold it and bought a farm equipment dealership in nearby Camden, which is a couple thousand
Camden,
people
I've been
where
to.
I went to school.
Now, is it pronounced Hibbert or Hibbert?
Hibbert is a little community I grew up in. So it was just a wonderful time in those years. I was the youngest of about nine boys in the neighborhood, and we played ball all the time, and I looked up to them, and they let me play around with them, and we just had a good time. It was swam in the creek. We didn't have, and we played ball. Whatever was in season, we thought we were going to be in the NBA. I guess we put up our own basketball goals. And
now, how big was your graduating class in high school?
30. There were 30 in my class. Almost everybody started the first grade. In my class was an Annapolis graduate.
Wow.
Several engineers. The most recent president of the University of Alabama.
No kidding.
And a bunch of engineers and bank president. And I don't know. These were all small town people who had good values. The families were tight. The schools reaffirmed the families and reaffirmed the church values that you were taught. I guess it was just one of those swell times to be a part of.
How long were your people down in that county? Which county? It's Monroe County, right?
Monroe County. To the early 1800s.
Wow. And Franklin's in Monroe County.
Franklin
as well.
Is not far from Hibbert. You've got it. Yeah. Franklin is a few miles down the road. My great-great-great grandfather or something, I think his father came before him, but in the 1840s, he was a circuit-riding Baptist preacher.
No kidding.
My mother's family, maybe 80 miles away from there, he was the last grandfather to come. He came in 1850 from Ireland and was a Presbyterian preacher who had a school and taught Latin and Greek. But we're just country people. All my grandfathers had farms. They had chickens and they had muscadine arbors and cattle and tried to get by farming for the most part.
Now, you grew up in obviously a very interesting period of time and not very far from Selma. Not very far from Montgomery when all that stuff was going on. And obviously, I don't think we even need to say it. You were probably in segregated schools, because that's just the way it was back then. What was it like? You were born in 46, 47? 46, right.
December 46.
What was it like your teen years with all that upheaval? What was it, because I presume, without making any assumptions, I presume that you grew up in a white community, and these were tumultuous times, right?
It was definitely segregated. We school buses passed each other. One would be going to the African-American school, and one would be going to the white school. And it continued a few years after I graduated from high school. We were segregated throughout the community, and it was pretty brutal, actually. Didn't appear to be on the surface.
Right.
People got along, and we had great relationships, but there was discrimination that impacted adversely the ability of the African-American community to progress. People did not were in denial about that fact.
Did you realize that at the time, or was that something that over the course of time and as these things?
Well, I did. I began to realize it. I don't feel like I did anything to damage the advancement of racial reconciliation and civil rights, but I wasn't any hero in it either.
Right.
We graduated from school and goes off to college, and then you begin to become really aware of how significant this movement was. But I think we pretty well realized that something big was going on. There was a resistance movement in the white community, and there was a determined civil rights movement by our neighbors and friends in the African-American community. They had right on their side. They conducted themselves in high standards, but with courage and determination, and they were victorious. They overcame.
Without putting you too much on the spot, and you can tell me to jump into that lake. what at the point in time, and I covered a lot of this when I was down in Alabama. I was interested. I got to meet James Bevel, who went insane. One of the founders of the Children's Crusade in Birmingham, Alabama. A very complicated time. A lot of people emerged very damaged out of that whole thing. But what would a conversation around the time that King was marching in Selma, or he was doing the bus boycott in Montgomery, what would a conversation around the Sessions family dinner table have sounded like back then? Were people trying to come to grips with this? What was it like?
Yeah, well, it was, people would be embarrassed about things that happened that were wrong, but there was not, in my family, we were not involved in politics at all.
Right.
My father never ran for office or supported anybody for office, and was not engaged in that at all. But I think people throughout the area were just in a constant state of tension. I mean, adults.
Right. Did they feel like they were under siege a little bit, right?
Yes. Oh, yeah. And so they would react defensively, mm-hmm. and too strongly. So the attacks would be taken as a personal attack on everything I've ever done, and basically you're an evil person.
Right.
So then people react not very wisely sometimes. I don't mean with violence or that kind of thing, but you're asking how did people handle themselves.
Emotionally, yeah.
Emotionally, it was one moment would be defensive, and the next moment a recognition that this was not a sustainable lifestyle, and it had to change, and it was wrong.
Now, obviously, Wallace was around when I, at the very tail end of when I was covering the Capitol. In fact, one of the first jobs I ever had was the death watch. There were multiple George Wallace death watches. He was a very ill man towards the end. You must have met him do you recall the first time you ever met Wallace?
I met him, I guess maybe the only time I met him was when we had a Boy Scout meeting in Montgomery, and he met 10 or 15 of us from different areas. I'm not sure why I was there. But with regard to the Wallace movement, initially he was very much a open, dynamic defender of segregation.
Right.
He didn't apologize for it
right.
one bit. The Republican Party, in many ways, grew up as a reaction to that, and a lot of people have misunderstood that. But when I was coming along, and we campaigned against George Wallace when I was in college.
So when did you become a Republican? Did you become a Republican?
Pretty early. I had an English teacher that got me to subscribe to the National Review.
It's always the National Review. It's the gateway of people.
Is that right?
I've,
I do run into a lot of people
Roger
who
Stone,
began that
I think
way.
Roger Stone said the same thing to me, that the National, he read the National Review in, Paul Ryan said it to me. A teacher gave him the National Review in high school, and it converted him. Something about that, it's magic.
Well, I've said many times, I told William Buckley, I said, you warped my mind, and I never recovered from it. But that was a principled, lawful understanding of the role of government, the Constitution. It was not based on racism or demagoguery, but on strong principles that which consistent with American heritage and our strength for the future.
To some extent, it offered you a path to conservatism that got you away from the racial question that really dogged the Democratic Party in Alabama, right?
That's true, yes.
So it was a different path to a conservative outcome that you wanted that was not part of that whole historical thing. Would you say that's one of the motivations?
I think that is correct.
Yeah.
People of my generation, I knew we need to move beyond that. The racial division and segregation and unsustainable social relations that were unfair to millions of people. But it didn't mean that we were going to become a big government
right.
liberal.
Right.
And so that was sort of, I don't know how many others, but I think quite a number of people evolved in that direction.
How did your folks react? Because this was several years before Nixon's Southern strategy and things started to move in that direction. There was not that usual a movement, right? And Senator Shelby didn't. When did Senator Shelby become a Republican? 92, 93? Much, much later in his career. You were a Republican from jump.
Well, Senator Shelby became a Republican in 86.
86, I'm sorry.
My parents. Both of them had teachers in their family and were pretty well read. So my father voted for Eisenhower.
Really?
He was very proud of it.
Oh, interesting.
He came home from World War II and he voted for Eisenhower. He was pretty thoughtful about those things, but never, as I said, ever campaign for anybody. He let me put a Goldwater sticker on his pickup truck, but he never put a bumper sticker on his car. We never had a yard sign or anything in our yards, never contributed to anybody's campaign. Well, so we were not that, but he was interested. He read the newspapers and read Time and U.S. News and World Report, and people in the stores would come along, you know, and they would talk politics.
So it wasn't apostasy. Well, I'll get us out of Alabama into the here and now. I just love Alabama. One last thing is another big figure that people totally forget about is Frank Johnson from Winston County, right? Winston Free County, which was a Republican county, one of the, I believe, the only really Republican county in the state consistently prior to whenever, right?
Yeah, Frank Johnson's family descended from like East Tennessee Republicans. Yeah. Winston County was a pocket of Republican. Even in the
Civil War
Depression days, yeah. When Democrats dominated Alabama, Winston County remained a Republican county, and all the elected officials were Republican.
And the great George Wallace quote about Frank Johnson, you know what I'm talking about. You want to give that man a barbed wire enema.
Well, it's a very intense time, and Frank Johnson...
we are talking about the federal judge.
Frank Johnson was recognized as one of the great federal judges of American history, I suppose. He was a law and order judge. He was classical, I think, conservative. But he believed that civil rights provided in the Constitution applied to everybody. And coming out of the Republican heritage of Abraham Lincoln, and he could see it more clearly than Alabamians would, which led to the big confrontations between Frank Johnson and George Wallace.
Which are epic. So one of the things that you, let's talk a little bit about Donald Trump. To me, one of the biggest moments of the campaign, the one that really cemented the fact that this was a serious candidate, was the Mobile rally early on, right? Was that the one that you were at and put on the hat? Tell me, I guess, rather than me talk about it, when did you first become acquainted with him? And obviously you had a decision to make early on between him and Senator Cruz. Can you kind of go through why it is that Trump sort of appealed to you personally?
Well, I had met Trump once before when he testified before a committee that Tom Coburn, Senator Coburn, and I hosted to deal with excessive expenditures to refurbish the UN building in New York. They were going to spend over $1 billion. He had been contacted by a delegate, a committee member on the committee from Sweden, I believe, because Trump had built Trump Tower for $200 million,
right,
and he was wondering why it cost over $1 billion to redo the existing UN building.
What year is this, roughly?
This was about, I can't remember. It was about 5 or 6 years ago.
Seems right.
7 or 8 years ago. Yeah. And he was a magnificent witness. I'm just, the reporter, when asking me about his testimony, said Sessions gushed about his testimony, but it was remarkable. I mean, he was clear. He knew exactly how you should refurbish a building. He pointed out event after event that were wasteful, and he promised if it was given to him, he would save the UN $1 billion in doing it. He came by my office and visited with staff here for a while afterwards. But so that was really the first time. I had not been involved in any way in planning the event in Mobile. My staff had really been contacted, but I had never talked to Mr. Trump about him coming to Mobile. And I decided I had something else to do, but it became so clear that it was going to be such a big event that I should be there. And he had already adopted my immigration views in large part, and he was saying things I thought were valuable about immigration.
And your immigration views, can you just sort of sum them up? Well, you were supportive of HB 56, right? And
what is that?
The Alabama law, the Alabama immigration law.
Well, no, I had nothing to do with that.
That was the Chris Kobach law. Well, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Yeah. That was passed. I didn't have anything to do with it, and never, to this day, hadn't read it, the details of it. I just read about it in the paper.
Right.
So he had a strong view that we were going to end the lawlessness at the border. We would use a wall. And then he laid out other principles of immigration that many of which were consistent with what I had said. He also had begun to question trade, which I have begun to question also. I've been previously voted for almost all these trade agreements, but had come to believe they were not working for the average American. So my view was that this excessive flow of immigration was impacting adversely the wages of American people, which is a plain fact. Also concluded that the trade agreements weren't working as promised and was depreciating the wages and the manufacturing base and the jobs of Americans, and that both needed to change, and he was out there. So I went to his rally.
And, did you see him before the rally? Or when
yes,
did you...
I went on the plane, and he had... My wife and I went on the plane and met with him, and when I went to the rally, I was down. He said, I might call you up, and I said, okay, but that was it.
Where was your head at in terms of presidential candidates at this particular point?
Well,
in
I was intrigued by him,
right?
Because, but it was pretty early in terms. This was August of a year ago.
I know.
And so we were having a big crowd in an old football stadium.
Sure.
In August, and it was, 20 or 30,000 people there.
And that really got your attention.
Well, yes, it did. It got the whole country's attention.
Right.
I think that may have been the biggest rally he had. And he had the cap that said, Make America Great Again. So I thought that was I like that. We do need to make America great again. And I put his hat on for a little bit, but I didn't endorse him. And But I thanked him for coming, thanked him for raising issues that were important, thanked him for talking about immigration and considering the views that we had worked on for a number of years on what a good immigration policy should be. And but he captured the audience. It was an incredible crowd.
The issue on the wall.
Just think about that. That was well over 25 or more thousand people, more than a year ahead of the election.
Did you?
I've never seen that kind of crowd. Maybe at the last weeks of an election, but not that far out.
When you came back to Washington, or when you, you know, you checked your phone messages and stuff, did you get any interesting reactions from other colleagues in the Senate, or like, what are you doing hanging out with this guy, Trump?
No, I don't. You know, I have had very little negative pushback. I think people in the Senate know that I have believed for a number of years and have been outspoken that we need to listen to what the American people are telling us, and we need to focus more on the well-being of people who make lower wages, $50,000 and below.
Give me an example. When you go back to Alabama, is there any particular constituent or an event that you've been to recently that really underscores that, where people have really come up to you and made this point?
Well, I hear it a lot. All you've got to do is be sensitive to what's going on, but people are not doing well financially. I mean, wages are down from 2000. They're down from 2007. 2000, down. Not going, they're below what they were in 2000. People are hurting. The percentage of Americans actually with a job today, workforce participation, mm-hmm. is the lowest in 40 years. Things aren't going well for them. Oh, yeah, the stock market may be up.
Right.
And corporate profits continue to hang in there. But GDP growth is flat. Where is it hurting the most? It's the lower income people.
Right.
They're the ones that have suffered, while certain people at the top heap, for one reason or another, have managed to do pretty well. And they're insensitive to what's happening to working Americans.
And you feel the Republican Party went astray on that. Now it was my understanding, just from reading about it, that it was sort of a choice between Trump and Senator Cruz for you, right? What kind of made you decide that Trump? Was it because of his greater focus on the economic stuff?
Well, he discussed it more clearly. He believed that the whole history of trade agreements, most of which I've supported over the years, have not been effective. And I've come to believe he's right.
When did you kind of come to that realization? Is it pretty recent?
Yes. I mean, I supported the Korean trade agreement in 2011. They promised, when it was signed, President Obama said it would increase our exports to Korea by $10 billion a year.
Right.
Well, that creates jobs in America.
Right.
That sounds good. Since last year, 2015, there was no increase. Like, instead of billions of dollars, there was like a $100 million increase in our exports to Korea, whereas their imports to us went up $12 billion, and our trade deficit increased 240%.
Right.
The same thing has happened with China. I voted for that, one of the worst votes I believe I've cast. I voted for that in 2000, and the numbers are the same.
If you voted in favor,
these are not they.
Could you get reelected again if you next time you run? When are you up again?
I've got four more years.
Four more years. If you voted for the TPP now, do you think that the voters of Alabama would make you pay for that?
Well, I'm against TPP, and I'm going to oppose it. So,
but I mean, in general, is the mood that strong back home now?
It seems to me, if a candidate ran for office in most states in the country, if his opponent or her opponent was an effective advocate against the TPP and could show, as I think we will be able to show, it's detrimental to working Americans, I think they would have a hard time getting elected.
And this is a wave.
Trump has made this a big issue. He's leading in Ohio. He's leading in right up there in Pennsylvania, one point difference. People are responding because the people's instincts are correct. This is what I I believe. So this is not a wrong thing for Trump to say. He's saying the right thing. We're bringing in so much labor, it's pulling down working people's labor.
But you feel like he's also capturing a wave here and representing something that you're feeling back home even before Trump. So it's an interaction between what people are feeling and Trump's capacity to capture that that's making this a big wave, it seems to me, right?
Right. Oh, I think maybe you've said that right. I have been advocating for some time that the Republican Party doesn't get it. And how do you appeal to Hispanics and African Americans that we've not done well with at all? Is it by saying we're going to have open borders and more welfare? Is that the way to appeal to working Americans? Or do you say we've been looking at our actions over the last 20 years, they've not been working very well, and we're going to make some changes that you'd like to see.
But let me ask you.
And can't we now appeal effectively to Hispanics and African Americans, other minority groups, as well as others?
So why is he doing not just poorly among Latinos and blacks, but historically on a record-setting, potentially a record-setting pace to underperform what other Republican nominees have done? Why do you think blacks and Latinos are not buying the message?
Well, that's not correct, first. That's just
his numbers? Not correct.
His numbers show he's running where Romney ran last time. And
he has an 87% disapproval rating with Hispanics.
He's showing 28% Hispanics are going to vote for him. It's going to be more.
You think so?
Oh, yeah, yes, it's going to be more, because right now he's saying we're going to end the lawlessness at the border. We're going to push Mexico to do better. And so there's been a reaction by the activist community to attack him. But by the time it gets to November, I believe they're going to see his economic policies and his strength as a leader as the kind of thing we have to get this economy moving. And we're not going to close our factories and ship them abroad. We're going to create factory jobs for recent immigrants, and he's going to take care of them. That's why he's holding his numbers even right now in this negative period are holding pretty strong, because people want a leader that's going to make this country great again and have a strong economy.
So do you think he's going to outperform Romney with blacks and Latinos?
Yes.
You do?
He's already doing that.
Well, I think we'll
see. We'll, maybe it's about the same level
we'll
right now.
We'll let people Google
it. But I think that it has under this huge attack of being accused of everything. But ending the lawlessness at the border, I don't believe a fourth-generation Hispanic thinks that's evil. I don't think an African American thinks there's anything wrong with protecting their jobs for a change.
But a lot of the issue, and you know, I interviewed Speaker Ryan last week, and he was talking about as a prerequisite for unity that Mr. Trump needs to change his tone on some of this stuff.
Well, I think he's moving to, and will continue to move to, the economic argument as to why what he's doing represents a commitment to stand up to big business, the international corporations who favor more immigration and lower wages. That's what they favor, and a defense of the interests of the American people who go to work every day.
So
that's what the challenge. That's what this election is all about.
So your advice is to keep with the. But have you told him to chill out with with some of the more extreme?
Well, occasionally he says things that are too strong and upsets people, and I think he'll work to do better on that. But also, it's shown,
Because you have a style. Well, let's just talk about you as a politician for a second. You know, I mean, there are a lot of people who oppose your positions in the Senate, but I haven't really heard people say ever really anything negative about the way that you interact with folks. You have a way of sort of articulating this stuff that doesn't put off people. Do you think he needs to learn a little bit about that?
Well, this is a critical time in American history. His strength, his willingness to stand up to political conventions, take on Republicans and Democrat leaders, and in effect do so in defense of the legitimate interest of people who make less than median income in America is the key to victory. I think he's been, I think it's an honorable thing that he's doing. He is, now we've got people in the Republican Party that I just believe that if you just cut taxes for corporations you have more trade and we just bring in more people from abroad, that this is going to help the average guy. Well, it's not. I mean, this is an honest dispute. We're going to have a dispute about it. And the American people agree with Trump, and I agree with Trump on those things.
So why do you think people like Ryan, and I guess he's become sort of the symbol of that stuff, what if you were to sort of give a message to Ryan, well, first of all, what do you think of Ryan's stance right now? We've had a bunch of back and forth over the last 48 hours. Some folks in the Trump campaign seem to have indicated Ryan was ready to make an endorsement. He came out sort of forcefully and said no. What would you advise Ryan to do, and what do you think of the way that he sort of handled the situation so far?
Well, my advice is to listen and accept the will of the American people or the Republican voters. The Republican Party is the Republican voters, and Republican voters oppose these trade agreements more than Democrat voters do. Republican voters believe we should have a lawful system of immigration that serves the national interest. They don't believe we should enter into commit the United States to further globalist policies that diminish the sovereignty and freedom of America to act in its own interest. They believe in a foreign policy that puts America first. Give me a break. And so a lot of our drift within our party has gotten away from that.
So you think Ryan needs to recognize?
I think he needs to recognize on some of these issues. Trump is where the Republicans are, and if you're going to be a Republican leader, you should be supportive of that. I would acknowledge that Ron has some really good ideas about things, and I think they'll get together, like taxes. Larry Kudlow, Stephen Moore, they've been supportive of Ryan's tax views, and now they're very supportive of Trump's. Now, so I think that's got potential. I believe Ryan's ideas about a new method to help convert our welfare system more effectively would be right up Trump's alley, and that could be a historic improvement, a second welfare-type reform that creates progress for poor people rather than dependency.
Now, you're playing a role on some policy stuff with the Trump campaign. They were very light in the policy area early on. How do you think they're give me sort of a status update in terms of the policy formulation shop and how you think that's proceeding?
Well, Trump is underestimated greatly. In terms of his understanding and comprehension of the great issues facing America. He understands trade. He's got businesses all over the world. He understands currency.
Right.
And how manipulating currency can be damaging to America.
Right.
When you make a foreign investment, you got to understand currency. He had a great energy speech yesterday. That was exactly what he should be saying. We need more American energy. It keeps wealth at home. It keeps our wealth from ending up in Venezuela and Saudi Arabia. It creates jobs at home. So it's good for us, and he's strong on that. His foreign policy speech got good reviews, and it says we're going to defeat the people who are direct threats to us, but we're going to be a lot more cautious about getting involved in long-term Wilsonian adventures.
But this was an interesting, there are a couple areas in policy that you have had disagreements with him historically over the years, one of which is you were a very ardent supporter of President Bush's decision in Iraq, and Trump has been critical of that. Do you think you were right? Trump has said it was a decision that never should have been made. Do you agree with Trump at this point, or do you stick with what you...
Well, it was a close question. I believe that President Bush was correct. I thought that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction, and I supported him steadfastly. And once we committed, we should see it through. And the greatest disaster of all was after all the difficulties and loss of life and expenditures, President Obama walked away in 2011, and it is a disaster. And now we've got half of Iraq under the ISIS control and terrorists, and they Iran has moved in because we weren't there, and they've taken more influence. Just a few thousand troops, in my opinion, would have avoided that. However, I think Donald Trump's history has shown that this was a very problematic thing. There were so many ways Iraq could have gone awry once we started, and I don't think most of us spent enough time considering the dangers. And we've seen what happened in Libya, what a disaster that's been, driven by Hillary Clinton, and the disaster in Syria, and almost disaster in Egypt. What a close call that's been. We're not out of the woods yet with Egypt. So the point of which is a more realistic Kissinger-type foreign policy is clearly, in my view, the proper tilt for us in the future, and he gets it. And some of our members, I guess, have been so deeply committed to the Bush agenda and the neoconservative agenda that it's harder for them to acknowledge that. But I acknowledge it.
Two other quick things. Again, I appreciate you taking the time. On the issue of immigration, which is obviously a pretty significant thing that has cemented your relationship with Trump, do you feel there's been some question as to whether or not his pledge to build the wall is a literal commitment? Do you think he will literally build a wall, and do you think it will literally be paid for by Mexico, or do you think it'll be some negotiated variation?
Well, we're going to build a wall. He's never said it's going to go from one end of the country, from the Gulf to the Pacific. And he'll use good judgment about that. And there are ways through tax and regulation policies that we can, and immigrant fees, that this could be paid for. I have not studied the details of it, but absolutely, I think that is possible. And as the witness last week testified before my subcommittee on immigration, that barriers magnify the ability of every Border Patrol agent to be more effective. And so if you make up your mind, you can build a substantial mileage of barriers. It will increase the ability of our officers to perform. And the most important thing is it sends a message to the world: the border is closed. Don't come. Let me finish.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Don't come unlawfully.
Sure.
And then the numbers of attempts will go down dramatically. And when and with barriers, a much higher percentage will be apprehended.
Right.
And as the numbers drop even further, you'll catch even larger percentage, and pretty soon you'll have essentially a lawful border, which we don't have today, and which the American people have every right to expect their government to produce.
But he can't back off too much on this, though, or he'll lose credibility with the core people, right?
He's got to effectively end the lawlessness at the border. That's a firm commitment he's made. It's not as hard as some people think. But a wall is a big part of it. It can be very helpful. And basically, you need to restore the morale of our officers. The guy that testified last week said, representing the Border Patrol Officers Association, that 80% of the people they apprehend are released into the country. So they catch them, and then they're released into the country. And they don't come back for court. It's just a total... It sends a message throughout the world that if you can get to our border, you got a 50-50 chance of getting in. And if you get in, you're in, and you don't have to be removed. And Hillary Clinton says nobody should be deported that entered illegally unless they commit a violent felony, which is an argument for open borders, and the American people reject that.
To what degree do you think the wall pledge is at the root of Trump's success within the Republican Party? How big a deal do you think the wall is?
It's pretty big. Somebody told me that it's, they thought it was the decisive event in his getting recognized, because people have heard nothing but namby-pamby comments from politicians for years. 30 years they've been asking for a lawful system of immigration to end this lawlessness, and government on both parties have refused to give it to them.
Right.
And what's wrong with asking for that? Is that some sort of nativist, racist idea? No, it's perfectly reasonable and responsible policy for any nation to maintain its sovereignty to protect its borders. And Trump does not believe in ending immigration. He's never proposed that. He said we're going to have a big door. He means lawful immigration will continue, but we're not going to allow the nation to be at risk in this fashion.
So let's circle back around a little bit. The last two questions. The in terms of the, you know, you've had people like David Duke, and there have been a series of reports that you've had sort of white supremacist organizations who are pleased with Trump. Trump has done some bad retweeting, he has admitted from time to time. To what extent does he have to watch that? You're very conscious of these kind of politics. You were raised in this environment. Talk to me a little bit about, does he have to do something to deal with the tone? Does it alarm you that people like Duke are drawn to his cause?
Well, I don't know. I don't even know what Duke said particularly, but he has certainly rejected that group. And
took him a little, it's no, taken Trump
can,
a
just
little
confusing
while.
About it. Okay. I don't believe there's anything significant there that suggested in any way that he supported David Duke or what David Duke said for. That was made a bunch of nothing.
Okay.
So there's been this attempt to block him in primary candidates and Democrats that to try to make everything he says some sort of extreme overstatement. But he's been bold. He's been bold on building a wall.
Right.
That was it did penetrate, as you suggested, to average American. He's saying to them, you elect me, and we're going to fix the lawlessness at this border.
Right.
And I'll build a wall, and we're going to stop it. And I think the elites who've done nothing about it, who don't want a wall and don't care that the border is illegal, they see this as a threat. So instead of engaging on the merits and saying, well, we want an open border, you know, we really do, and that's all good for America because they know the people will reject that, they attack him as an extremist, which I think is unfair.
Well, Mo Brooks, who's a congressman from your state, I think said something that encapsulated some people's thinking, sort of talking about the white working class. And you know, Wayne Flint from Auburn wrote that book, Poor But Proud, about sort of the white working class in Alabama. And this is the group that Trump is appealing to and the group that's really angry over these trade deals. What Brooks said is he thought the Democratic Party had come to represent a war on white folks. Do you think that there is a sense among core white working class voters in the South that the parties have left them behind?
Well, I think it goes beyond race. I think the people who go to work every day don't feel like Washington cares a whit about them.
Right.
And that actually they're executing policies that are bad for them.
Right.
One of them is an excessive flow of labor, and another one is bad trade deals. And we're going to prove these trade deals are not working. They did not do what they promised to do. And we're not going to end trade. That's very important to state, but we're going to have to be more careful about it. And we have to recognize as politicians, we don't represent some international company.
Right.
We represent our constituents. And so they don't get to dictate policy. You know, whose interest are we representing? So we should create an America in which Americans have a better chance to progress wages and job prospects. And we can do that.
But you don't think
we are getting cheated. And so that's the deciding issue out there.
And you don't think race has anything to do with any of Trump's appeal?
Trump is going to appeal better to African Americans, Hispanics, and others than previous Republican candidates, because he's talking about what they want, a fair chance to have a better life economically. And so I just don't think there's that many people who think it's wrong to have control on our borders. That's not racism. It's not racism to question some of the political correctness today that's going on, to recognize that things aren't going as well as for American workers as they'd like. because people, their frustration is arising from a deep sense of unease that Washington is fiddling while their house is burning.
And Trump isn't going to go away, you think. After 2016, this is not a spike. This is going to be the future of the Republican Party, this wave, this feeling.
I think that and believe that the real future of the American Party is to bring in working Americans. You've got the principled people who may be on salaried jobs or CEOs and entrepreneurs and all of those that are great people. But if you're not appealing, and the permanent coalition is to join that with traditional Americans who feel like that things aren't going well for them, and to develop policies that improve their lifestyle, not just the upper income lifestyles. And once that's believed by working people, that it's serious and a commitment, and you care about people like me for a change, Republicans could create a new majority.
I swear this is the last one. Out down this hall in that Capitol, that's a millionaires club that the U.S. Senate is. You know that very well. I haven't checked the ratings lately. I don't think you're at the very top in terms of income in that group of people. How do you sell what you have just said, this notion that Trump has of economic populism, to a Republican Party that has been for all these years run by vastly wealthy people?
Well, I think leaders in all parties tend to adjust to reality. They just have to, or they won't remain in office. And as they see a coalition like this building, they'll want to be a part of it. Already many are sensing it. People tell me, well, do you understand where the voters are, Jeff, where the votes are, or what people are thinking? And they'll sort of in a complimentary way. It's a bit of an acknowledgement that we've been blind to some of these issues.
You must feel vindicated in the cloakroom now, as you have more of a consolidation behind Trump now, right? Are you seeing more and more people coming up to you and saying, Jeff, you saw this coming a little earlier than other people?
Yeah, you hear that some. So we just need to adjust to this. And Trump, I think, understands it. He has said this is going to be a new Republican Party. It's going to be a workers' Republican Party, instead of just the elite Republican Party. Romney didn't get beyond the number. He couldn't get 50%. Romney got killed by under $50,000 a year income voter. He just got killed in that. You cannot win. You cannot be President of the United States if people below 50,000 don't think you care about them. And you have no real communication that motivates them to vote for you. And that's the trend we've been on, and Trump has broken that. These voters are saying, I like this guy. He just might shake this place up.
But what if
I am not happy.
If he loses, does it default back to what it was, or is this the new politics?
Well, your guess is probably as good as mine, but I would like to think that we're on a move that could be like Reagan. Reagan appealed to the average working American. Their patriotism, their love of country, their belief in their schools and their communities and their loyalty to the military and police and the things that create stability and a good life. He appealed to that group of people, and we can do it again. Because they've had now 8 years of Obama, things have not gone well. What did he give us? More taxes, more regulations, more Washington domination, more debt. Those things are not the future for America. They will never work. Those policies, more taxes, more regulation, more debt, more spending, more government, will make America worse. It just will, in my view. And so we'll have a national debate about it. And the goal should be to bring in, to help respectfully appeal to those voters that can make the difference. The ones who are not going to be entrepreneurs, are never going to be a CEO at some big business, and they know it, but they would like to have their Social Security. They would like to have Medicare as they paid for all their years, and they'd like to have rising wages rather than falling wages.
Is there one thing you want Trump to change? Anything? If you were to make one adjustment, what would that be?
I don't know that I would. I don't have anything on my mind right now. He can improve and get better as he goes along, and I think he will.
What's the best piece of advice?
The good piece, yeah. I liked his energy speech he made yesterday. Yeah. I liked his speech on foreign policy. What he's showing is that his fundamental views are solid and that there's an intellectual basis for this, an economic basis for what he's saying, and that it can lead him to victory.
Well, I took way more time from you than I was allotted, and I appreciate it. Thanks very much, Senator.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
Bye-bye.